His phone says, great, you're a tower. Here's my info. And you can use that to set up a fake cell phone tower. And you'll query all the phones in the area, and you now know who is here. Now, you know, 15 years ago, the FBI was using that in the United States. The product was made by Harris Corporation, it's called Stingray. And they were using it basically for surveillance. And it was a super secret in the United States. They would let criminals go they would drop prosecutions rather than describe the techniques in court. And a bunch of examples of the FBI keeping this a secret. Well, this, of course, it's not a secret. In like 2013, Vice ran some Stingray detectors around the DC area, found a bunch of dozen of them, run by actually, we don't know who, around US government buildings and foreign embassies. And you can go on Alibaba.com and buy yourself one of these for about $1,000. You get a software-defined radio card, there's open source software. In China, they are used to send SMS spam. And so it was once a big secret, and now it's not. And all because the authentication really doesn't exist. So up to now, this has been a manageable problem. And nothing I've said here is new. And we've been living with it. And it's been largely okay, but that's changing. And what's changing is how computers are used. What's changing everything is becoming a computer. What's changing is automation, autonomy, and physical agency. They bring with them a lot of real new dangers. So if you work in computer security, you most of the time, you deal with confidentiality, privacy. You worry about data theft, worry about data misuse. And all of the computer security stories that make the news tend to be stories about someone stole a whole bunch of data. And if you studied computer security, you know something called the CIA triad. It's not that CIA, it's different CIA. It stands for confidentiality, integrity, and availability. Those are three basic properties we're expected to provide. And you think about availability threats, DDoS, ransomware. Think about integrity attacks, manipulating bank balances. Right? So we do have to deal with them. But most of the time, we're dealing with privacy. But when you get to computers that affect the world in a direct physical manner, the integrity and availability threats are much worse than the privacy threats. And the effects are much greater because there's real risk for life and property. So I am certainly concerned if someone hacks my hospital and steals my private patient medical records. But I am much more concerned if they change my blood type. I don't want them to hack my car, turn the Bluetooth microphone, eavesdrop on my conversations. But I really don't want them to disable the steering. And that hospital hack is a data integrity attack. That car attack is a data availability attack. And so think of the things that are out there, cars, medical devices, drones, weapon systems. As an aside, there was a report in the United States about U.S. computerized weapon systems. Security is a disaster, really bad. Our only hope is that theirs are just as bad and nobody's weapons are going to fire. Thermostats, power plants, smart city, anything. And we're starting to see. We saw the city of Atlanta basically held hostage by ransomware. And we've seen our ransomware affect cars. We've seen DDoS attacks against critical systems. And there's a fundamental difference between your spreadsheet crashes and you lose your data and your embedded heart monitor crashes and you lose your life. It could be the exact same CPU and operating system and application software and vulnerability and attack tool. The only difference is where the computer is and what it is. And that's going to change everything. At the same time this is happening, some of our long-standing security paradigms are failing. And I want to talk about three of them. The first one is patching. So our computers and phones are basically as secure as they are for two basic reasons. One, there's a team of engineers at Apple, at Microsoft, at Google, that designed them to be as secure as they can in the first place. And those same engineers are on call to quickly write and promulgate patches to our systems, and to bring them back to security that we've always discovered. We don't know how to write secure software, so we are agile about patching. So that ecosystem serves us pretty well, but it doesn't exist for low-cost embedded systems, like DVRs or home routers. Those are built at a much lower profit level. They're often designed offshore by third parties. They don't have secure teams associated with them. Their engineers come together, write the code, and then disperse. There's no one there to write the patches when vulnerabilities are discovered. And even worse, a lot of these devices have no way to patch them. Right now, the way you patch your home router is you throw it away and buy a new one. That's the mechanism. There is no other. But actually, that throw it away and buy a new one is a pretty good system. And we get security for the fact that we throw away our phones every 3 years, our laptops every 4 or 5 years, and every time we get a new one, it is more secure. The hardware is more secure, the firmware is more secure. That also isn't true for embedded systems. You're going to replace your DVR every, 7 to 10 years? Your refrigerator every 25 years? I bought a home thermostat 2 years ago. I expect to replace it approximately never. Or think of a car. Now you buy a car today, say the software's 2 years old. You're going to drive it for 10 years. You're going to sell it. Someone else will buy it. They'll drive for 10 years. They'll sell it. At that point, it probably gets put in a boat and sent somewhere in Asia. Or someone else buys it and drives it for another 10, 20 years. All right. When you get home, buy yourself a computer from 1976. Boot it up. Try to make it secure. We have no idea how to secure 40-year-old consumer software. And there is a reason that Microsoft and Apple depreciate their operating systems. It is hard to maintain old stuff. Do I expect car manufacturers to keep a test bed of 40 years times 20 models? That seems a bit crazy. I don't think we expect them to depreciate cars like depreciate phones. I think that would be an environmental disaster. We don't know how to do this. We don't know how to do patching at scale around these fringe cases. It's not something the market can fix, because really neither the buyer nor the seller care. But you might have a DVR at home that's part of a botnet. A lot of them had default passwords. They're part of the dime botnet, the code has been public. They're now in a couple of hundred botnets using that, those vulnerabilities. You have no way of knowing. And kind of you don't care. It's DVR, it's working, what's the problem? And it's going to be in botnets until you throw it away. And that's going to be a security problem. The second thing that's starting to fail is authentication. Now, authentication kind of only just barely works. Right? You know, passwords are really how we do authentication. And there's a lot of situations where human memorizable passwords are no longer sufficient. Two factors great when you can use it, you often can't. And people, every single back authentication system is much worse than the primary it's backing up. But authentication is about to change. And right now, when I authenticate, to do one of two things. I authenticate to an object, right? I authenticate my phone, which usually is a thumbprint. Or I authenticate to a service. So right now, I am authenticating to an email server. Right? That's either me authenticating to an object, or me authenticating to a process. What we're going to see the rise of is thing-to-thing authentication, where things will have to authenticate to each other without us being involved. Right? And you have to do it at scale. So if you think of a driverless car, people have to authenticate to thousands of other cars, and road signs, and traffic signals, and status messages, and emergency messages, all in real time, all ad hoc. We know how to do that. I mean, well, we can do it that way. Or even stuff around us. Right? If I had 100 IoT devices in my orbit, that's 10,000 authentications. If I have 1,000 IoT devices, that's 1,000,000 authentications. We don't know how to do that either. But we can do some of it. And right now, when I go into my car, this device automatically authenticates to the car, right, and uses the speakers. That's Bluetooth, that works fine. But if you remember, it works because I was there to set it up. And I'll do that for 10 things or 25 things. I'm not doing it for 10,000 things. I'm doing it for 1,000,000 things. And similarly, if you have an IoT anything, you likely can control it through your phone. Now your smartphone has become the de facto IoT controller hub. And that will work for 10 things or 25 things. But you're not going to have 100 apps. You're not going to have 1,000 apps. So we really don't know how to do this thing authentication at scale. The third thing that's failing is supply chain. And supply chain security has always been a disaster, but it's one that we all like to ignore because solving it is insurmountably hard. But it's becoming a serious problem that we need to think about. So in the United States earlier this year, if you pay attention to supply chain, there were two stories that made news. The first one was Kaspersky. Should we trust a Russian-made antivirus program? The second one was ZTE and Huawei. Should we trust Chinese-made handsets and network antivirus? Okay? Because this isn't just a US problem. In 2014, China banned Kaspersky. Actually also banned Symantec at the same time. 2017, India banned about 40 different smartphone apps that they thought China had infiltrated. Back in 1997, I remember debates in the United States about China. Should we trust an Israeli security company? And in 2008, ISIS came out with an encryption program called Mujahideen Secrets, because of course you can't trust Western-made encryption programs. But this really is just the tip of a much more complex problem. Where are the chips made? Where is the software written? Where is the device assembled? Where are the programmers from? And this might be an American product, but it's not made in the US. Its chips aren't made in the US. Its programmers probably carry 100 different passports. And that's the supply chain problem. And we've discovered backdoors in Juniper firewalls, in D-Link routers. We don't know who placed them. 2003, I actually urge you to look this up if you're interested. There was a very clever backdoor that just barely didn't make it into the Linux distro. And we got really lucky in discovering. We don't know how many more we have in discovery. And there's even more. You have to trust the distribution mechanism. We know there are fake apps in the Google Play Store. You have to trust the update mechanism. Remember that NotPetya was distributed through a hacked update to a popular Ukrainian software package. You have to trust the shipping mechanism. Remember the story with photos of NSA employees putting backdoors in Cisco equipment just as the Syrian telephone number. I saw a paper a couple of years ago, you can hack an Apple phone through a malicious replacement screen. And more recently, there was another story about supply chain. This is a Bloomberg story. And the story is that China put a hardware backdoor, a special chip, onto motherboards for networking equipment destined for the American market, specifically the Amazon and the Apple cloud. It was a very long story about this chip and how it was done. Apple has denied it. Amazon has denied it. The Department of Homeland Security in the United States says it wasn't true. The UK counterpart said the story is not true. Bloomberg doubled down. Yes, the story is true. We have 40-something sources. We stand by it. We're a follow-on story. My guess at this point in the story is not true for a couple of reasons. One, if there was a chip on a motherboard that pervasive, we would see a picture of it by now, and someone would show us one. And two, it's kind of a dumb way to do a backdoor. I mean, a lot better is to slip another layer into a chip mask or to put the backdoor into the firmware. That's how professionals do it. China's going to do it that way. But the real story of this story is that we don't know. We have no way of knowing. And that's the problem with supply chain security. You can't trust anybody, yet you have no choice but to trust everybody. And we don't have an answer. And we can make kind of like a US-only version of this, which costs 10 times as much on lag. Now for all of us, with the exception of China, our industry is deeply, deeply international in a way that cannot be unraveled. So we have no answer here. So I kind of see this as a perfect storm. And a lot of things are failing just as everything's becoming connected. And really, we've been okay with an unregulated tech space because basically it didn't matter. And that's no longer sustainable. So primarily, I think this is a policy problem. Getting a policy right is critical. I think the primary lesson of Edward Snowden is that law and policy must work together. Right, we always knew that tech can subvert law. What Snowden disclosure showed us is that law can subvert tech. So I just finished a book that speaks to a lot of policy. It has the awesome title of Click Here to Kill Everybody. You laugh, but that actually really, you know, catches their eye at airports. And there's a lot of parts to tech policy, right? Standards, regulations, liabilities, international agreements. It's not an easy problem, but I think it's one that we have to start paying attention to. I want to pull out two principles I've got in the book. The first one is that defense has to dominate. So basically, we have one world, one network, one answer. Right, traditionally, when you look at national intelligence, you know, my NSA and your equivalent, they had a dual mission to protect our stuff and spy on their stuff. And that dual mission worked because our stuff and their stuff were different. Now everyone uses the same stuff. And we all use TCP/IP and Cisco routers and iPhones and PDF files. So you have a choice. Either you secure our stuff, thereby inadvertently and necessarily securing their stuff, or you leave their stuff vulnerable, thereby inadvertently but necessarily leaving our stuff vulnerable. Right? Either everyone gets security or no one gets security. Either everyone gets a spy or no one gets a spy. And that is a security versus security trade-off. It is not security versus privacy. It is security versus security. Right? There was an article 2 weeks ago, the Russians and Chinese eavesdropping on President Trump's iPhone. Surprising nobody. What the article didn't say is that every single U.S. congressperson and senator also carries one of these phones. Like every leader of pretty much every country on the planet. And either they're all secure or they're all insecure. You can't have it both ways. You can't have a back door without leaving your cell phone. And I talked about INSI catchers, stingrays. And we see that in other ways. We see that in BGP security. NSA calls it traffic shaping. The Chinese and Russians call it something else. But basically, you reroute traffic on the internet so you can eavesdrop on it better. Right? We can do it. Everyone else can do it.
we make that secure, we are vulnerable. But as these systems become more critical, we must design for security, not for surveillance. Defense has to dominate. A second principle I want to mention is that we need to build for resilience. We need to assume in security and design systems that work anyway. And we know how to do this. It's defense in depth, it's compartmentalization, it's avoiding single points of failure, figuring out ways to fail safe or fail securely, removing functionality, deleting data, having systems monitor each other. And I think a real promising IoT security mechanism is to give the router some smarts. And I've seen this called manufacturer's usage descriptions. And the idea would be that you buy a refrigerator, you install it, connects to the internet, and the router says, oh look, it's a new refrigerator. Goes out, gets the signed list of things that a refrigerator is allowed to do. Right? It's allowed to access these ports, communicate this way, to these IP addresses. And if the refrigerator starts sending email, the router says, refrigerators don't send email, and stops it. Right? And maybe that's not the way to do it, but the solutions are going to be like that. It's going to be things monitoring other things. The real question in policy is how to get from here to there. And in my book, I spent a lot of time talking about regulation, which is a hard argument to make in a small government, libertarian, Silicon Valley world. But I'm not convinced there's any option. That already computers are moving into areas that are highly regulated. Airplanes, cars, medical devices, power generation, even consumer appliances, large and small. And the devil is in the details. I have most of my book, but really just from it. And I think that governments are going to get involved regardless, because the risks are too great, the stakes are too high. We're starting to talk about robotics and actual robots. It's things that affect the world in a direct physical manner. And I argue when I give this talk in Silicon Valley that look, your choice is no longer between government intervention and no government intervention. It's between smart government intervention and stupid government intervention. And the point of having this conversation about what regulation will look like is to have the debates before there is a crisis, before something must be done. So I think doing this right, regulation incents private industry. Right, the stated argument is that regulation stifles private industry, stifles innovation. And that is the argument you hear from pretty much everybody who doesn't want to be regulated. I don't think that argument holds any water. But we've heard it with restaurant sanitation codes, hasn't stifled innovation. We heard with automobile safety regulations, hasn't stifled innovation. I think we do it right at least innovation. Because right now our problem is not a lack of tech ideas, it's lack of adoption of tech ideas. Because the economics doesn't favor security. The economics favors insecurity. Yeah, I don't remember last year, the credit bureau Equifax, that affects New Zealand. The United States, there was every person had their identity stolen. Equifax is a big credit bureau. And people were livid. The American lawmakers were really incensed. I testified before a House committee, and there were angry congresspeople on both sides of the aisle. Something must be done. Here it is, like 14 months later, absolutely nothing was done. The lesson Equifax learned was, skimp on security, hope for the best. If the worst happens, weather the press storm, you'll come out okay. I assure you, Facebook is in the process of learning that exact same lesson. And there's no incentive these companies to buy clever security. What good regulation does is it raises the cost of insecurity, which means companies will spend more on security to avoid paying the higher cost. All right, so Europe is moving this direction. You've all heard about GDPR. It's about privacy, it's also about security. There's also other regulations in Europe that are coming into form. And you see products, they have this CE on the label. That's a European mark. Basically means conforms to all applicable standards. There's already an applicable European standard on responsible vulnerability disclosure. They're working on one on secure defaults, on cash management. And those are the kind of things that get incorporated into trade agreements, like GATT, and they sort of propagate around the world. In the United States, the federal government's doing nothing, but states are leading the way, specifically California, Massachusetts, and New York. Last month, California passed an IoT security law. I mean, it's kind of mediocre, it's not that great, but it's a start. New York is regulating cryptocurrencies, Massachusetts is doing a bunch of stuff. At the federal level, the regulatory agencies are trying to look at things. And you'll see in the news the Federal Trade Commission suing, they're suing D-Link right now. They're suing different internet companies, basically for deceptive trade practices. They're claiming that stuff is secure, leaving nothing in it. Now, my guess is in the US, Congress will come very late, if at all. But the international considerations of this are real interesting. And because of the way software works. Right now, the car I buy in the United States is not the same car I buy in Mexico. Environmental laws are different, and the manufacturers tune the engine to the different laws. But software doesn't work that way. And if California has a new IoT law, and the maker of the thermostat has to remove the default password and comply with the law, they're not going to have two different software builds, one for California and for the rest of us. And we will benefit, just like we are all benefiting from GDPR regulations protecting privacy. Even though we may not be under the jurisdiction, software tends to be right once and sell everywhere. So, and again, I don't see a lot of alternatives. I mean, there is an industry in the past 150 years that has improved safety and security without being forced to by a government. Cars, planes, pharmaceuticals, food production, medical devices, restaurants, consumer goods, workplace conditions, financial products. But the market doesn't reward security. The market rewards making the product as insecure as you could possibly get away with. And we are now living the market solution. If we want better, we need to force the market to do better. And lastly, when I think of what we can do, and by we I mean all of us in this room, is that we technologists need to get involved in policy. This is important. Right? As internet security becomes everything security, internet security technology becomes much more important to overall security policy. And all the security policy issues have strong tech components. And we'll never get the policy right if we get the tech wrong. So you see this in the Going Dark debate about backdoors. You see this in the equities debate about what to do about vulnerabilities. You see this in the voting machine debate. I don't know what they do in your country. It might not be an absolute nightmare. You see it in driverless car security, in AI security. And if you watch that Apple versus FBI debate unfold, you saw technologists and policymakers talking past each other. The DMCA debate has the same problem. Anybody watch the Facebook hearings in the United States? Right? That's an example of what happens when policymakers don't have any idea how technology works. So we need to fix this. Right? We as technologists need to get involved in policy discussions. Inside government, we're both as legislators, in federal agencies, at NGOs, as part of the press. Some of us full-time, some of us part-time, some of us are doing advocacy. We have knowledge, we have expertise that is needed
right now by policymakers. And this is actually bigger than security. Right? I mean, all of the major issues of our century have strong tech components. Climate change, food safety, future of work. Right? We need to build a world where there's a viable career path for public interest technologists. So right now, I am teaching internet security policy at the Harvard Kennedy School of Government. And I'm trying to teach internet security tech to policy students. It's interesting. The Kennedy School of Government is something like 50 years old. And when it was formed, it was populated with economists. Because in the last century, the fundamental question of public policy was how much of our lives are regulated by the market and how much of our lives are regulated by the state. And that is the difference between East and West. That's the difference between political parties. The fundamental policy questions of our century are different. It is how much of our lives should be governed by technology and under what rules. Which means policy shops need to be populated by technologists. That's important. If we are going to solve the tech problems of our century, we have to help. We can't leave it to the policy. Or bad policy habits for us. So thank you.